you're fortunate to have him as General Counsel and Director of Education for the TNCDC. Ryan.
Thank you very much. All right. All right. Welcome back, everyone. See a lot of familiar faces. How many of you, this is your first rodeo? First rodeo? All of you, veteran players. Excellent, excellent. Okay, well, let me go ahead and lay the groundwork. I want to remind you that this is going to be the subtitle of this presentation is Just Enough Case Law to Make You Absolutely Dangerous. I will be giving you kind of the headline news ticker version of information as it is streaming across the bottom in terms of things that have happened during the last year. I want to go ahead and remind y'all, the way that we do this is there's a cutoff date. We use August the 31st through October 1st as a cutoff date. So in other words, all hand-downs that came down after October 1st of 2009, we've been gathering them. We've been studying them. We've been synthesizing them. We're cooking them up. We're getting ready to roll them out. We'll have them ready for you in the next academic year, which, by the way, starts like in October. So let's be honest. Moment of truth. How many of you? You're here because you procrastinated. How many of you, this is the last train to Clarksville, and I'll meet you at the station. All right, okay. Glad to have you here. Let me go ahead and jump on in. We're going to talk a little Fourth Amendment issues first. I want to talk to you, first of all, about Gantt. This is probably the decision that got the most attention out of the last term of the Supreme Court of the United States, or SCOTUS, as we will refer to it. We have seen kind of a, I don't know if we want to call it a creep or a subtle expansion of the wingspan rule as it's been understood by police officers and criminal law practitioners. Quick show of hands, how many of you, in addition to being municipal judges, are criminal law practitioners? Okay. This is probably the paramount case from the last term for criminal law practitioners, because what we have seen over the period of about 25-odd-some years has kind of been this, what some people think is wingspan out of control, okay, in terms of where can a peace officer go once a person has been arrested. Let me talk to you about a case that I saw when I was working at the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. I still remember this case very clearly because I was so kind of outraged by the ultimate resolution of the case. Man is arrested at a payphone in Houston, and he's 50 yards away from his car. And after he was arrested at the payphone, police officers searched his car, not as part of an inventory, but as part of wingspan officer protection to make sure that he did not have access to any weapons or that he could possibly destroy any evidence. All right, now a couple of things are notable about the scenario I've just given you. One is the fact that I talked about telephones, payphones, something that your grandchildren and your children will have no clue what that even means if I say the word payphone. Probably already there. When was the last time you saw a payphone? Any of you? Have you seen a payphone? Heck, you can't even see a payphone at a jail anymore. All right, here's the second thing. Unless you are a member of the Fantastic Four or you have other some type of supernatural powers, no one can reach 50 yards away from the payphone to the car. All right, now, I use that to illustrate what essentially, but by the way, the Court of Criminal Appeals said that was justified use of peace officers' wingspan protection. They said that was justified, even though it was 50 yards away. What we see in Gantt is a retraction of the wingspan rule. Beginning with New York versus Belton, this case kind of acts as a girdle of sorts. It begins to pull back on what they told us in Belton. And they remind us once again that for a peace officer to, that the Fourth Amendment is going to require a peace officer to demonstrate that there is a legitimate safety need to the peace officer or the need to protect, preserve evidence. In other words, just because the person had a car at the time that they were arrested, without more, it's not going to justify the ability of the peace officer to search the vehicle. All right. In this specific instance, the man was arrested, but he was not in close proximity to his automobile. Nevertheless, they searched the car, they found incriminating evidence, and that's ultimately what the Supreme Court said was an illegal search. All right, now, before you internalize this, if this sounds like this is a real game changer, on some levels it's not a game changer at all, because this case, and let me stress this, has absolutely nothing to do with the inventory searches of automobiles, which is an exception to the Fourth Amendment. In other words, the wingspan rule, peace officer safety, that's a Fourth Amendment rule, Okay? But when we talk about inventorying people, the content of their automobiles, you know, someone gets arrested. Let's say it's a DWI arrest. You know, what's inside the car? So we got some chapsticks. We got a Michael Bolton CD. Why would anyone have a Michael Bolton CD? I mean, come on, move on up to MP3, right? I mean, you got all those personal items, and that is considered to be an inventory. So in other words, that's the government, they're just looking out for your property interest, right? Okay, that's the wink, nod. They're looking out for your property interest. What we know is that quite often, when looking out for your property interest, they sometimes happen to find kiddie porn, sawed-off shotguns, brass knuckles, methamphetamine in the back of the minivan, things of that type of nature as well. And that the case law reflects that. So the Gantt is definitely a contraction of the wingspan rule. That's how we will conveniently label Gantt. Safford, this is a case that many folks who practice school law or who are involved in juvenile defense work, there was a lot of interest in this case. We were told in an earlier case called New Jersey versus TLO that when a child goes to school, they do not leave their Fourth Amendment rights at home, that they have Fourth Amendment protections at school. In New Jersey versus TLO, however, the court also stated that the Fourth Amendment protections of the student had to be counterweighed against the legitimate needs of schools that they have in maintaining order and being able to teach. And so we understand there's a weighing analysis, but you don't throw the Fourth Amendment out the door just because a kid goes to school. That's the reason why they have school handbooks. How many of you parents have actually read the handbook that comes home with your kid? Have you noticed how many releases? You're essentially, on many levels, giving lots of permissions. Can you as a parent waive your child's Fourth Amendment rights? That's one of those issues that still is kind of the undiscovered country. We tend to think that people still have their own Fourth Amendment rights. Children do. The exercise of them, not as clear. Let me tell you what this case was about. You probably heard about this case. This is one that actually did show up on the ticker of Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, regardless of what your cable news addiction source is. This showed up on all of them. This was the case where the young girl got caught with Advil in her bra and panties. Do you remember hearing about this? And then the school officials searched her, okay? And the real question was, you know, was this an illegal search? And the answer is yes, and this case doesn't change that. What people were wanting to know in Safford was, would the Supreme Court be willing to change its former holding in New Jersey versus TLO to give school officials more increased ability to search children? Would they be willing to kind of back off of this? Yeah, the Fourth Amendment applies to children at schools. Would they back off of that? The answer is no. They have not backed off of that. They reaffirm the holding of New Jersey versus TLO. In fact, for most of you, this case really doesn't have much interest. It's not that important, unless, do any of you practice school law? Any of y'all represent school districts? Because if you represent a school district, or if you're involved in special ed stuff, this does have to do with the immunity of school officials against civil suit. That became another part of the opinion, kind of outside the mainstream of what we're interested in for our purposes. All right, which brings us up to Herring. We're now on page 2. Question posed, does the exclusionary rule apply to evidence seized incident to an arrest unlawful under the Fourth Amendment due to erroneous information negligently provided by another law enforcement agency? All right. The answer is no. All right. Now, let me talk to you about this case, and let me talk to you about an earlier case that came out of the Supreme Court. In Arizona versus Evans, which is a 1995 Supreme Court decision. Do I have any Arizona versus Evans fans out there? Any of y'all got any Arizona versus Evans t-shirts, memorabilia, caps? Okay. This was a Supreme Court case that said that when your clerks screw up in recalling warrants, that the exclusionary rule does not apply. In other words, let's say you've issued the capias profine and turns out that the person had paid it, or they pay it before they're arrested, and you tell the clerk, recall the capias profine, and they don't recall it. Or let's say it's not capias profine. It could be any writ that results in a Fourth Amendment seizure. It's just a regular arrest warrant. In Arizona versus Evans, what the Supreme Court said is the failure of the clerk to recall the warrant does not trigger the exclusionary rule. In other words, let's say your warrant didn't get recalled, someone gets arrested, they find kiddie porn, Could they argue exclusionary rule because the warrant should have been recalled by the clerk and they didn't and they screwed up? No. That's what they said in Arizona versus Evans. All right. In Arizona versus Evans, they said because the purpose of the exclusionary rule is to deter police misconduct. And the court clerk is part of the court work group. So obviously, inapplicable concept. Okay, well, that's exactly where the people in Herring based their argument. They based all of their energy off of Arizona versus Evans. Because in this case, who screwed up was not the court clerk. It was the secretary for the police department whose job was to control warrants. The warrant clerk for the PD screwed up. So the same the rationale that was underlying Arizona versus Evans becomes the thrust of the argument in Herring. Because they said, okay, now you said, you Supreme Court said, that the exclusionary rule did not apply in Evans because it was a court clerk's error. Well, guess what? This is the police department's error. Thus, it should apply. Nope. Here's the reason why. This is an interesting case. If you read the Chief Justice's opinion and you contrast it to the dissenting opinion written by Ginsburg, those are the two key opinions in here. What Roberts says is that, once again, the purpose of the exclusionary rule is not to give criminal wrongdoers, you know, a free pass. It's not the purpose. Nor is it the, you know, they say, we want to remind you again, the whole purpose of the exclusionary rule is to deter misconduct by police officers. So in other words, unless it is clear, based off the facts, that the application of the exclusionary rule would deter police misconduct, it's not the policy to, you know, it's not proper to use the exclusionary rule. A couple of side notes. One, let's remember the exclusionary rule is a court-made rule, okay? It's not stated in the Fourth Amendment. It is something that has been created by courts over a period of time, okay, based off of the Fourth Amendment, okay? So this is supposed to be the paddle, but the paddle that's only used on police officers, but only if it will deter other peace officers from doing bad stuff. There it is. That's as simple as it gets. That's what it's supposed to be. Here's what happens, though. The court found that there was nothing in the record to show that this was a campaign of sinister, underhanded, bad record-keeping on the part of the police department. Even though the record showed that warrant practices were sloppy, that there was very little effort to manage the recall of warrants, they said, so what? Sloppiness is not the same as malicious intent to violate the Fourth Amendment rights of citizens. That's the majority position. The dissenting opinion, as written by Justice Ginsburg, is, well, how would you ever really know? I mean, how would you know if the police were just being sloppy or if the police were engaged in a malicious campaign to violate people's Fourth Amendment rights by being slow and inefficient at recalling warrants so that they can then nab people? How would you ever know? And her position is, since you can't know, then it should apply. The exclusionary rule should apply. Once again, the votes aren't there. The majority position still is, no. The record has to show that there was a malicious or a maligned or, you know, that poor faith, bad faith conduct was engaged in by law enforcement. All right. Questions on anything coming out of the Fourth Amendment? Thoughts, fears, or concerns? Doing good so far? Check out your neighbor. Make sure everyone's got a pulse. You're awful quiet this morning. I know we got the mood lighting going on. I will tell you that this hotel serves the best coffee of any coffee I've had at any of the regional judges' schools. So thumbs up to the hotel because that was mighty fine bean. All right, let's move on. Warrants. I've got a gratuitous blood warrants case to talk to you about. Then I'm going to talk to you about this confusing issue of supplementing search warrants. Okay. Why do I say it's gratuitous? Because blood warrants are the thing. I mean, if you haven't noticed, you know, there's not a chief of police in Texas now who is not having regular conversations with the police, with either newspapers or with television affiliates. You know, how many of y'all are living in parts where you've got like a no refusal Wednesday or no refusal weekend? How many of y'all are doing that? We're big in Austin. We're doing no refusal. We're doing blood warrants. We got them going on. Municipal judges issuing a lot of them. Okay, well, this is not a huge case, but it is worth knowing. Okay, with a regular search warrant, the rule has always been that the person who is scrutinizing the warrant, in other words, the trial court judge, is supposed to show due deference to the reasonable inferences that the magistrate made to the probable cause affidavit submitted to them. Okay? That's always been the rule on search warrants. Dugas answers the question, what about blood warrants? And the answer is, yeah, it's the same as any other search warrant. There's no difference. In this particular case, the magistrate authorized the blood draw warrant, but the affidavit did not state what time the police officer believed the person had been drinking alcohol. You could tell from the form of the probable cause affidavit that it was on the same day that the request had been made. That's a reasonable inference when you examine the document in its entirety. However, the trial court judge did not find that to be a reasonable inference and told the state, you're not going to get to use any of the blood evidence to prove DWI. That's what was appealed, and that's what was ultimately reversed by the Court of Appeals in Dugas. All right, so that's Dugas. Let me talk to you about Rogers. Rogers is a supplementation case. Now, this is one that, for me, really smacks of a need for appellate review by the Court of Criminal Appeals, because I don't want to believe that the Texas Constitution or the Fourth Amendment has varying applications depending on where you live in the state of Texas. But that's exactly what Rogers tends to suggest. Okay, how many of you have as magistrates, issued a search warrant before? How many of you, a good number of you. How many of you have ever issued a search warrant for a condominium, apartment complex, or hotel? Any of you? Okay, these types of multi-occupant residential structures pose real logistical problems for law enforcement, okay? And they can pose real logistical issues in determining probable cause. Why? Because you have to be specific as to the unit, okay? You know, if you think about it, you know, you want to know what your idea of having a bad day is. Your idea of having a real bad day is when your house is subjected to a home invasion under the authority of law because some deputy sheriff got the unit number wrong when they were trying to figure out which condominium they wanted to search, and they ended up coming into yours after they kicked in the door. So what we have seen is a slow splintering that's occurred within, there's been this slow splintering among the Court of Appeals as to when it comes to these unique structures, apartments, condominiums, and motels, can you identify the street address, and then allow the peace officer at a suppression hearing, either at a district or county court, typically, to state why they thought that Unit 13A was the right unit to be searched. Or does it have to be in the search warrant affidavit? If you're like me, you're probably old school and you go, no, four corners rule. It all has to be in the four corners. You can't just say 1600 Main Street, you know, the Drama Hotel. You have to say 1600 Main Street Drama Hotel, room 12A, 7th floor. You have to put as much detail in there as possible. Okay? Well, first of all, for those of you, hopefully most of you have not had the opportunity to tour crack houses, okay, or hotels that have become crack houses, but sometimes those numbers don't mean jack in an abandoned building or a vacant condominium or a shack of an apartment complex. That's a real logistical problem. Well, this is what we've seen happen. Two courts of appeals, the two in Houston, have stated that they will allow police officers to supplement after the fact, after the execution of the search warrant, if it's called into question by the criminal defense lawyer, they will allow you to raise the issue at the trial level, and then the defense lawyer could take the person on cross-examination and grill them as to how they knew that was the right unit. In other words, they will allow you to supplement your search warrants in Houston. Now, keep in mind, it's Houston. We're talking about skyrise capital of Texas. They got more condominiums, more apartments, more things of that nature. Now, not everyone's down with that rule, including the El Paso Court of Appeals. How many of you are within the jurisdiction of the El Paso Court of Appeals? They don't accept that rule. They say absolutely not. It's got to be in there. Four corners. Four corners. It's got to be in. We don't care if it's a home. We don't care if it's a porta potty. We don't care if it's a barn. We don't care if it's a 25-story office building. It's got to be in the four corners. Corpus Christi has joined the El Paso Court of Appeals, stating, no, 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 we're not going to allow supplementation on search warrants for multiple occupants' residential dwelling structures. However, in this specific case, we see that the two Houston Court of Appeals are willing to acknowledge the exception because of the logistical problems posed to law enforcement. And in this case, Texarkana joins the list. So now what you've got is you've got three courts in Texas that will allow supplementation, and you've got two courts that have said absolutely not. All right? Now, well, the supplementation would occur at a suppression hearing. Okay, so I issue the search warrant, and then what happens is the criminal defense lawyer is going to move to suppress, typically like in the trial court, and then at the trial court pretrial suppression setting, that's when all this stuff, well, Officer Jones, how did you know it was 13A at the hotel drama? Okay, that's, for me, that really, how many of y'all kind of find that shocking? That would be allowed. It really does fly up in the face of everything we heard in law school about the Four Corners Doctrine. I mean, it really, truly just is completely contrary to what we learned about Four Corners. And so, you know, I have to tell you, it's one of those things that now that you've got two courts of appeals saying absolutely under no circumstances will we allow supplementation, and now you've got three courts of appeals saying, yeah, we'll allow you to do it under very narrow, limited circumstances. It has to be multiple occupant residential structures, hotels, motels, and condominiums. All right. Well, you know, I have to tell you, the former president of the National District Attorneys Association, Kathy Eads, who's now a municipal judge, who probably at one point in his career was the most outspoken advocate for prosecutors, thinks this is a horrible opinion. He thinks this is a slippery slope and that you're putting blind faith in the law enforcement officers to put good information up on the witness stand. Why wouldn't they put it under oath? Why couldn't they put it? Yeah. Go ahead, yeah. They're talking about multiple occupant residential. That's all they said in the opinion. Could it? I don't know. I have to tell you, you know, I'm from Vernon, Texas. We don't have a lot of sky rises in Wilbarger County. I have a hard time relating to the, you know, and guess what? I have imagined, you know, if you're a flatlander, if you're from the Lubbock area, this is like, what's going on here, this tall building stuff? I mean, how hard is it to figure out, you know, which room is Jethro in? 12B. All right. Okay, so that's kind of what we're looking at here. Moving on. Okay, it was a real bad year, okay? I got to tell you, 2008, 2009, real bad year to be a criminal if you weren't smart on the law. Let's go over the year in review for reasonable suspicion cases, because, man, I got some real doozies. First of all, littering. Page 4. I mean, where was your head if you never heard Don't Mess with Texas? Do you think that when we said that on bumper stickers and had Jerry Jeff Walker sing songs about this, that you didn't think we would also have criminal law enforcement to back up our policy of don't litter in the state of Texas? Okay, Mr. Simmons is getting, he is within the plain view of a police officer, and he sticks his hands in his pockets, and he pulls out a bus pass, and he tears it, and it's torn into pieces. The bus pass falls onto the ground. Does Mr. Simmons bother to pick up his bus pass? No. At which time, my 4-year-old would have told him, you are making a bad decision. Okay? He makes this bad decision. The police officer arrests him. The whole case is based off this. Can you be arrested for littering in the state of Texas? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Remember, there's only two exceptions from when a peace officer must afford you the opportunity to sign a written promise to appear. Speeding and open container. Everything else, you are fair game to being subject to a warrantless arrest. In this case, it wasn't even reasonable suspicion of littering. It was probable cause to believe that a criminal offense had occurred within the plain view of the peace officer. So there's no need to go get a warrant. We're good to go. He can arrest him and then explain in an affidavit why he arrested the guy. Okay, now, that's one that just shows you something that I've been figuring out over the last 10 years. Maybe y'all have already figured this out because a lot of you have been doing this a lot longer than me. The collective value of understanding these Class C misdemeanors is probably greater than understanding any one Class C misdemeanor. How many of you know what I'm even trying to imply by that? What I'm saying is a police officer who knows the elements of one Class C misdemeanor is probably not much of a police officer, but if you've got a police officer who knows all 867 state Class C misdemeanors and knows the elements of them and is prepared to make arrests for people, man, probably all of us could potentially be getting arrested. You know, how many of you even knew that the Parks and Wildlife Code makes it a Class C misdemeanor to illegally dispose of cat litter in a cave? Anyone? Anyone? Okay, that's my point. All right. You know, but you know, somewhere out there, you've got some, you know, some bandito who's dumping that cat litter, and here's the law. Bum, bum, bum. Got you. Calling you on it. Hands behind your back. Oh, by the way, I think you're also, you got marijuana in your truck. I think. It's a pretext, but I'm arresting you anyway. Okay, then we can have a real Gantt situation. How close was the cat litter disposal to the vehicle? All right, now, here's my point on this. Patterson is a perfect example of how people who even study these things don't even necessarily know the law. I didn't, so here we go. Let's see how well prepared you are to answer the following question. All right, you come out of your house. It's a sunny day, okay? It's a wonderful, sunny Saturday, and you're going to go for a walk. You walk out of your house, you have a sidewalk. Are you required under Texas law to walk on the sidewalk if there is one? Anybody want to say no? How many of you just don't know? I don't know if Mr. Patterson knew. The answer is failure to walk. If you have a sidewalk and you don't walk on it, it's a Class C misdemeanor. You're subject to full custodial arrest. Okay? Let's go on to the next one then. Let's say there is no sidewalk. Okay? Now you're going to have to walk in the street. Under Texas law, are you required to walk in any distinct direction? Absolutely. What's the policy? Must you walk with the flow of traffic or against the flow of traffic? How many of you say you walk with the flow of traffic? How many of you? Okay. One, two, anyone over three, four, five? How about you walk towards the flow of traffic? Okay. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. About the same number of people who raise their hands about being criminal defense lawyers. What, did your clients encounter this at some point in time? Here's where I'm going with this. Oh, yes. Mr. Patterson, maybe he should have taken the time to pick up a copy of the TMCEC LexisNexis Texas Criminal Laws book in transportation, the brick as we like to affectionately call it, because I had no clue. Yes, transportation code is very clear. If you have no sidewalk, you are required to walk towards traffic. Will you walk towards traffic? Bicycles have to move with the flow of traffic. By the way, we're coming to see you next year about laws relating bicyclists, because we're quickly discovering that somehow bicyclists, some of them just don't even believe that any of the laws apply to them. Okay, but we'll talk more about that next year. So when it comes to the pedestrian, they have to walk towards traffic. And if you ask me, as a Texan, this makes perfect sense. Because if I'm going to get killed by a car, I'm going to go eye to eye with that vehicle that's taking me out. Come on, bring it, bring it. Let's see what you're going to do. Take me out. I don't know. I personally don't get that, but it is true. You're required to walk towards the headlights that are going to kill you. It brings a whole new meaning to the phrase, walk towards the light. Okay, yeah. Okay, all right. Well, I have to tell you, it might be some old farm policy. It does seem a little strange to me. Some people, you know, they're going to get killed. They would rather not see what's going to kill them. All right. It's embarrassing to get killed by a smart car. That would be embarrassing for most people. You mean I got killed by that? I mean, hit me with a Mack truck, but not like a Tonka toy. You know, a Tonka toy. Yeah. Proper side of the crosswalk? Man, I've already admitted a lack of knowledge about the rule about which way to walk on the street. Well, really? Okay. Well, that's news to me. Okay, here is the thing that Mr. Patterson also didn't know. I need to throw a couple more variables on here. One, okay, Mr. Patterson is a former known drug dealer, okay? Did I mention he was in a school zone? I might want to say, did I mention he had drugs on his person when he was arrested? Oh, yeah. By the way, maybe even if you're not going to master the transportation code, Mr. Patterson, you might want to stay away if you're the known community dope dealer. Don't walk around in school zones with your product on you. Okay, that might be another good tip, because this was the difference between a Class C misdemeanor versus a second degree felony. Okay, because of the fact he had priors, he got busted with drugs on his person. I'm trying to remember again. Oh yeah, let's also not forget that this whole thing went down in Amarillo, and I know we've got the judge from Amarillo. You don't mess around in Amarillo anyway. They don't take kindly to people walking the wrong direction in Amarillo. All right. You know, don't mess with Amarillo. That's the new catchphrase. Forget don't mess with luck. How about this? Don't be a drug dealer in a school zone in Amarillo and walk on the wrong side of the road. It's too long maybe for a bumper sticker. All right, so that's Patterson. Now, you see, this is my trend on reasonable suspicion. Does everyone remember what reasonable suspicion is? I mean, I know that we've been doing this a long time. Every now and then I'm embarrassed to say, everyone remembers what this is, right? But I need to make sure you all remember what this is. Reasonable suspicion, unlike probable cause, probable cause is the amount of information that would lead an average, reasonable, cautious, and prudent person to believe that an offense has or is being committed. Reasonable suspicion, lower down, that is something that is articulable. It is something that a peace officer can articulate more than a hunch as to why they believe that illegal conduct. In other words, you never, ever, ever, as a prosecuting attorney, when you take the police officer at a pretrial hearing, you've got him on the witness stand. Now, Officer Jones, why did you believe that that illegal conduct was occurring? You don't want to hear any Chewbacca sounds, okay? You don't, you know, no. Why did you think? Well, I'll tell you why. Based off my training as a peace officer, I smelled the odor, which you know how they drill. Y'all all know the drill. Based off his glassy red eyes and the sweet smell that I smelled coming from his, you know, it's almost like automatonic training or something. They have these canned lines. That's reasonable suspicion, okay? They have to be able to say it. All right. Now, Chisholm is the example. It is the exact opposite example. This is like, okay, everything that happened in Simmons, let's play it backwards on Chisholm. Because in Chisholm, what happens is the police officer arrests this man for panhandling. Okay, now, it's a city ordinance violation. I get this question all the time from judges and from, I've been asked this question by, heck, I've been asked this question by even a district judge once. May you be arrested on view for a city ordinance violation? Absolutely. The only exception in state law is, once again, open container and, you know, the Lone Star Beer or Shiner Bock endorsed exception, open container and speeding. But everything else, you know, City of Waco has an ordinance that says you can't leave your vehicle unattended while fueling up, okay? Because you might have spills. I mean, we'll call this the BP ordinance, okay? That one you can be arrested for, okay? How about this? City of Austin has a glass container ordinance. You walk outside of a 6th Street bar holding a long neck made of glass, can they arrest you? Absolutely. Can you be arrested for violating the panhandling ordinance? Absolutely. And police legal advisors customarily teach their police officers to know city ordinances. Because y'all know that pretextual arrests are okay. That's Wren, the Wren decision from the Supreme Court. We know I can arrest you on A when really I just think that you're up to B. As long as I have probable cause on A, pretextual arrests are okay in the United States of America. So you could have a police officer busting people on panhandling ordinances when they really think they've got crack cocaine in their pockets. And that would be okay. That would be all right. Now, here's the problem. If you are a police officer and you're doing this, you'd be well advised to know what the ordinance says. Because what happened in this train wreck of a case is that during the suppression hearing, the following evidence came out. It was discovered that, guess what? There is a panhandling ordinance. And it only applies in the latter hours of the day near dusk. And this man was arrested for panhandling at 10 a.m. when the panhandling ordinance did not apply. Now look, it's just us in here. Are any of you surprised that maybe the police officer did not know the elements of the city ordinance? I mean, heck, I'm a city prosecutor. I've got code enforcement officers that don't know what the city ordinance say. And that's the only thing they do is enforce them. Okay? Now, let's go one step further. The next thing that happens at the suppression hearing is that the peace officer says that the reason why he patted the person down was that the person was a transient, was homeless, And it's his policy to always pat down homeless people. All right, criminal defense lawyers, that's where you're supposed to make the Chewbacca sound. Okay, no. You can't pat people down based off of status. I can't say I pat down people who went to Texas Tech. Okay, I refuse to pat down people who went to Texas Women's University. You can't use any statuses like this. And you can't say it is my policy to always pat down homeless people. Why? This is what he says. Well, I'll tell you why. Because in my experience, they always have needles on them. That doesn't work either. So this is a pretty good case to read if you want to see an appellate court backhand a police department. Completely backhand them out of the tennis court. Because the fact of the matter is, this is exactly what reasonable suspicion does not allow you to do. You can't have a policy, I pat down everyone who's a college kid. You can't do that. Labels don't work. Remember, reasonable suspicion has to be articulable, and it can't just be because of X, because they are X, all right? We certainly, homeless people are not, they don't get some subversion, some remedial version of the Fourth Amendment. They get the same protections. All right. Right to counsel. This is one of those areas that is changing, so quick that by the time I come back and talk to you, Montijo will have new implications by the time I get to Tyler, because this is already starting to tilt on newer case law. Let me talk to you a little bit about Montijo. This is a case out of Louisiana, and what happened, excuse me? Oh, did it slip over on the page? No, it's there, isn't it? Page 6? Montijo is on 6. There we go. It is on mine. You got it, Montijo and 6? All right. Here's what happens. This guy is arrested on murder charges. He's brought in to see his first judicial officer. Judicial officer makes the query as to if he requests the assistance of counsel, and he stands silent. Okay? And the question is, and this gets a little bit, what does it take to accept, okay, or to invoke your Sixth Amendment right to counsel? That's the real question. Do you have to affirmatively say, yes, I hereby, in the name of myself and my family and all the people who were born before me and after, hereby invoke my Sixth Amendment right given to me by the Supreme, by the Constitution. What does it take? Are there magic words? And what occurred in this case is that he didn't say anything, okay? He filled out a piece of paper and at one point he nodded his head, but he never affirmatively asserted his rights. Now, I got to stop for a second and tell y'all something. This is some hardcore constitutional criminal procedure nerd stuff, but it's very important for you magistrates to know the nerdy part of the law, okay? One, Fifth Amendment invocation versus Sixth Amendment right of invocation of rights is significantly different, okay? The Sixth Amendment is the king's X. Once you've invoked that Sixth Amendment right to the assistance of counsel, they cannot talk to you. They cannot come back to talk to you. There is no cooling off period. That is what we have all been taught from law school. It is the king's X. It is daytime. You've got the crucifix. The cops are Dracula. They got to stay away. That's it. That's Sixth Amendment. Fifth Amendment, a little bit different. Fifth Amendment, that old Miranda stuff, they can say, hey, I'm reading your Miranda rights. You want to be quiet? Yeah, I want to be quiet. I want to talk to you. All right. They get to leave, and then they can come back later after a reasonable cooling off period and say, hey, you still want to be quiet? Yeah, I still want to be quiet. That's the difference. Fifth Amendment, okay, wears off. Sixth Amendment, it's invoked, it's King's X. That's the reason why this is such a big deal. Montijo's lawyer said he invoked his Sixth Amendment King's X rights, and that nevertheless, they then took a confession from him that they used to convict him and sentence him to death. That's the deal. That's the big deal. Louisiana Supreme Court said, yeah, but he had never affirmatively accepted it. Gets all the way to the Supreme Court, and then Ann Scalia does something that only Justice Scalia can do. Basically tell everyone that they're wrong, okay? He tells everyone that they're wrong. Not only does he tell both parties that they're wrong, he then tells the Supreme Court that we were wrong and all of our case law on this is no longer any good. Can I get four more votes to join me on reversing about 60 to 70 years worth of case law? He gets his four votes, and now it's a new day in America, because this is what he says. He finds that all this stuff about the difference between Fifth Amendment and Sixth Amendment is just too blasted confusing. We would be better off if we had one singular test, and let's use Miranda, because Miranda is what people know. We could use the Miranda formulation for purposes of both Fifth and Sixth Amendment and not get into all this King's X nonsense. And this is where things really get strange. Because you've got Justice Stevens who is saying that what you are doing now in this opinion is telling everyone who practices criminal law, and you're telling every court in the United States of America, that all of our earlier cases about Fifth and Sixth Amendment may no longer be right, and that we may have to start over in figuring out how to apply this. And I guess Scalia's probably nonverbal response is, this is how many votes I have. Count them. I got 5. How many do you have? I got 5. Okay? And that's exactly what happens. Now, so you've got Stevens disputing all this. The other thing that's very interesting about this is that you have Alito and Kennedy who think that in Gantt, New York versus Belton was completely overturned, whereas the other members of the court don't think that New York versus, by the way, New York versus Belton is the wingspan rule, okay? They don't think they overturned it. They think that in Gantt, they just modified it. But these other guys, you know, you got Alito and Kennedy going, well, hey, look, if stare decisis didn't matter then, why should it matter now? Let's let go of all that stuff and go in a new direction. We think Scalia makes sense. So that's how Scalia gets his 5 votes. All right, now, this is where it gets very interesting, and this is a preview for next year's case law update. How many of you have been watching the news and have seen that in this most recent term, they have now modified Miranda? Have y'all heard about this? Because now for you to invoke your right to be silent under Miranda, you have to verbally incite your... In other words, you have to say you don't want to say anything. If you think about that long enough, it gets a little dizzying, okay? And that's where this case comes in. That's where we're back to this case. This was the precursor to what the Supreme Court's done in the last 2 months. The first thing they did is they merged the Fifth Amendment, that they have... To quote a little Ghostbusters to you, they have crossed the streams, okay, between Fifth Amendment and Sixth Amendment case law, and now they've come back in this most recent term and they put one new construct on it, which is, no. To invoke your Miranda rights, you're going to have to say, I want to invoke my Miranda rights. And that's where we are now. Now, developing. We're going to have more development on this. We will have a further discussion on this next year. All right. Now, Pacina is a Texas case. This is a Court of Criminal Appeals decision. I'm curious, how many of you as magistrates, it is your custom to accompany law enforcement to hospitals, to other places, to magistrate people? How many of you do that? Any of you? Okay, you've done it? Okay, do you do it at the request? Do you do a ride-along? You ride with the cops? Yeah. Aha, where are you from? Okay, well, this is good. Okay, well, I'm going to talk about this, though, because this is the exact reason why it happened in this case. Okay, I'm a big fan of history, and I can tell you that back in 1963, the day President Kennedy was killed, that the JP in Oak Cliff rode along with the police department so that they could issue search warrants on demand so they could get into places immediately. All right, they didn't have time to go get the JP and get, they needed it immediately. But other than, you know, manhunts for wanted presidential assassins, typically the whole idea of doing a ride-along with the cops is frowned upon in judicial circles because you're supposed to be neutral and detached. You're not supposed to be their, you know, car 57, where are you, buddy? Okay, no Adam 12 type of relationship. You're not supposed to, we don't want judges in cop cars. We just don't. And sadly, there's no such thing as a judge car. Maybe there is in your town, but most cities don't have the budget for a judge car. Do y'all have a judge car in Dallas? Does the city not have a municipal court car? Oh, I forgot. I know, reduction in force, so bad timing on my part. I apologize to Judge Robinson. I retract the question. All right, now here's my point with this. All right, so what happens in this case, Pacina is a bad man. Pacina is in the hospital, and we've got a municipal judge from Arlington as a magistrate accompanying law enforcement to the hospital. This does not look good. If you just want to all be civil libertarians for a second, or even if you're not a criminal defense lawyer, just pretend you are, or pretend like you used to be one because some of you used to be them, okay? Think about this. You're taking the magistrate now to the hospital. Why would you do that if they haven't been arrested yet, even if they're under guard? The first thing you can do is you can arrest them as soon as they're discharged and take them. The answer is given to you from the judge from Plano, because it has nothing to do with the law and has everything to do with dinero. It has everything to do with greenbacks, okay? Because the second the person is magistrated, the duty for paying for health care shifts from the arresting agency to the county that will be housing the prisoner. I have no idea where this comes from, but it seems to be universally accepted in the state of Texas as being true. So, in other words, who wants the magistration done the most, okay? The ACLU or the finance director and the city manager for your municipality? Yes, it's the bean counters. They're the ones who want you to get down there and magistrate that person so that they'll stop billing the city for his medical care because T.J. Hooker hit the guy with a baton. City cop hit him, okay? City cop took him to the hospital. Now they want to shift the cost over to the county. That's the magical part of this. But guess what happens? Sometimes you get cases like Pacina, because the magistrate, while there, had this little encounter with who initiated the contact. Remember, once you've invoked your Sixth Amendment right to counsel, it's King's X. You can't talk to them anymore. They're off limits, okay? You can't dance with them. They're done. But if they initiate contact with you and say they want to talk, ta-da, everything's good again. No King's X. In this case, Pacina's lawyers argued to the Court of Criminal Appeals that it was the state that initiated contact. What the state's arguing is, no. We brought the magistrate, and once we brought the magistrate, Pacina initiated contact with us. Who brought the magistrate? What does that look like to you? It obviously looks like you're bringing the judge to the hospital bed. The facts of this case are very unique, but you ought to read the facts of this case. The facts led all but one member of the Court of Criminal Appeals in an 8-1 decision to find that the state initiated contact at the moment they brought the magistrate, and the magistrate asked the question, do you want to talk to the police? Okay? So, I would just say, I understand bean counting, oh, do I ever. And I understand reduction in force. And I understand the politics of city managers, okay? But I'm going to say to you as magistrates, you better be careful with this one. This is the one that you need to watch out for. I am not comfortable with folks doing these, going to the hospitals. I'm not. I'm not comfortable. I understand why it's necessary. How about this? How many of you have a DA that won't even take a case on intake until they've been magistrated? That's their new rule after Rothgary. They won't even do a review until you get down there. Okay. So that's where this comes from. Okay. Wolf. Wolf is the worst case to come down in the last year. This is the case that I am most concerned about, even though it is a intermediate court of appeals decision. It is a, in my humble opinion, to be blunt, this is a bad decision. And it has a lot of potential to be misused and to confuse matters. So let me tell you a little bit about Mr. Wolf. Mr. Wolf is, in the common nomenclature, a thief, okay? And to be more specific, he works at Dillard's and he steals pants, okay? I'm from Vernon, Wilbarger County. We call those britches, so we'll call him the britches bandit, okay? He likes to snatch britches from his employer, Dillard's. Now, I don't know what happened. I guess just like each and every one of us, Mr. Wolf puts his pants on one leg at a time because he was ultimately apprehended and caught by law enforcement for stealing pants. He hires a lawyer. He's being charged with misdemeanor theft in county court. Y'all need to file this part. I need to stress, he's in county court. He's facing Class A theft charges, maybe Class B. That doesn't matter. It's A or B. Now, here's the next thing. He hires a lawyer. The lawyer says, okay, what's your objective here, Mr. Wolf? And Mr. Wolf goes, okay, my goal is, I just want to tell you what my career plans are. I don't want being convicted as a thief to interfere with my long-term career goals, okay? Well, what do you want to do for a living, Mr. Wolf? And this is the part that is so perfect in light of the American history we have all collectively just experienced in the last 16 months. I want to be an investment banker. Think about it. A thief who wants to be an investment banker. I told you the timing of this is perfect. Okay, now, we know what his career goals are. The lawyer goes and works out a deal with a prosecutor where he can get 4212, I'm using the exact proper 4212 deferred adjudication, with an agreement that upon completion of all the requirements, he'll get early discharge. How many of you are all familiar with the type of terminology I'm using on this, okay? And he then goes and tells his client that when you're done, your case will be sealed. Okay, now, this is where we get into more fun with words with Ryan Turner. It's going to be my own sitcom or my own show on National Public Radio, Fun with Words, okay? In Texas, we have deferred disposition and deferred adjudication, and they're not the same, okay? And the real difference between deferred disposition and deferred, well, there's a lot of differences. I wrote a whole article on this a long time ago, but one of the big differences is that with deferred disposition, you can get it expunged under, what is it, Chapter 57? It's over in the Code of Criminal Procedure. 51? 55. You can use Chapter 55 and get that bad boy burned out. No trace that it ever happened. However, with non-disclosure, the best you can hope for is non-disclosure. There is no expunction for a deferred adjudication under 4212. The documents will be there. Now, let's talk about what that means. Expunction means destroy. Non-disclosure means you've got to be on the VIP list to look inside the folder to see the documents. We won't disclose it to just anyone. You've got to be on the VIP list. Now, just follow me now. There's a third word that exists in Black's Law Dictionary. It's called sealing. When you seal a document under common law, what that meant was no one can look in the folder. It's kept by the custodian of records. Are any of y'all licensed to practice law, like not in Texas, somewhere else? Because I think other states use real sealing. And you have to go to a district court, typically, or a district-level court, and petition to have the seal broken on the sealed document. Our political heroes in Austin, however, they have made a train wreck out of this, okay? One, tomorrow you're going to get to hear about how non-disclosure jumped the fence and is now living in the world of municipal and justice courts when it comes to children. That's no fun, okay? But we say in our non-disclosure statute, how many of you have done one of these for a client before? How many of you have worked a non-disclosure case? You know when you read the non-disclosure case, you get about halfway down the statute. What word do you see? Sealing. When the record is sealed, it is sealed. It's not sealed the way that everyone else who understands legal words in the United States or in the common law system thinks it's sealed. Non-disclosure is not sealing, is it? Because someone can still see it without a court order. They just have to be on the VIP list. All right, here's where everything starts going south in this case. So, Mr. Wolf, the britches bandit, gets 4212. He gets early discharge. He graduates from his junior college. He gets a job. You want to guess where he's working? A bank, okay? He's working at a bank, and now he's getting ready to become, ready for this? Financial analyst. He's going to be certified he's going to get his dream job. And guess what happens when the state of Texas is going through the licensing procedure to get him certified to be an investment banker? Guess what happens when they run his criminal background check? The licensing agency is on the VIP list. They find his conviction for being a britches thief. Okay? They find his theft. Okay. He's fired immediately by his employer. He's terminated, okay, because he had not disclosed this during the hiring process. He then turns around, and this is where it all gets crazy, files ineffective assistance of counsel claim against his criminal defense lawyer. All you criminal defense lawyers, this is where you need to perk up. You can go back to sleep in about 65 seconds, but this is the part you're going to want to listen to, okay? What happens next is he files two claims against his criminal defense lawyer as being ineffective. One, he claims that his criminal defense lawyer was negligent by failing to attempt to get him a pretrial diversion. Can anyone cite to me exactly in the Code of Criminal Procedure where pretrial diversion is contained? Why can't you? Because it doesn't exist. What happened to the last attempt to make pretrial diversion part of the Code of Criminal Procedure? Do y'all remember that bill that got filed after the CDL masking thing? Happened in 2005 or 2007. Couldn't even get out of a committee. Couldn't even get a committee hearing. There is no pretrial diversion. I know you folks sometimes get it for your client. That's based off the fact that you're suave and debonair and it's a local practice in your county. That is not something that the state of Texas has given you. Yes? Well, I'll tell you why. Because, first of all, let's just make sure we're all clear. Is there any such thing as a statutory pretrial diversion in Texas? Nothing. No. It's a custom that's based off, typically because I used to be in the DA's office, and you used to be in the DA's office, we know each other, and I'm sorry, he's a screw-up, he'll never do it again, please give us some mercy as part of justice. Okay, that's a pretrial diversion. He doesn't do anything wrong, we'll make it go away. You can get it expunged, because after 2 years, if there's no affirmative action on it, then you're entitled to expunction because of the term. Yeah. Unless you waive it by contract. Okay, now, let me go in on this now. So, that's his first claim. The second claim is municipal. Now, some of you are saying, this doesn't relate to me, this doesn't relate to me. Why are you talking to me about this? Now I'm getting ready to make it relate to you. Here's the second argument. The argument is that the lawyer was ineffective because he did not attempt to get his client a Class C special expense pursuant to Article 45.051 of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure. Anybody remember what 45.051 of the Code of Criminal Procedure is? That's deferred disposition. Can a county court grant a deferred disposition? Absolutely not. No, it says at the beginning of Chapter 45 that the provisions in 45 govern courts that are bound by 45, municipal and justice courts, and we've had a couple of special courts that have been created. Generally speaking, your county courts cannot use Chapter 45. They can't. Now, what the argument is brilliant. He's saying that the lawyer is ineffective because the guy was accused of a Class A misdemeanor, and his lawyer, one, did not get him something that's not even contemplated by the Code of Criminal Procedure, specifically a pretrial diversion. How many of you know criminal prosecutors that there's no way in hell they're going to give a thief a pretrial diversion? It all depends. If it's a first-timer, maybe. If this is your second rodeo, kiss it. It ain't happening. Okay, it just depends on who the DA or the county attorney is, right? Okay, well, here's the second thing. Or that they didn't get the client something that he couldn't, that the court could not have even granted. That's where this gets crazy. What happens is, even though the Houston Court of Appeals in the past has acknowledged that deferred disposition is not deferred adjudication, in fact, I give you the cite to the case in which they do it. That case is called Jamshedji. It's in the commentary to the case. What they now do is they say, well, deferred disposition is deferred adjudication. It's kind of like the same thing. I mean, we think it's like the same thing. And why he didn't get him a deferred adjudication under 45051 special expense fee Class C, here's where the Court of Appeals really blew it. What is the Class C special expense fee? What is it? It's something you pay in lieu of having to pay a fine. It's the way that the government gets your money without calling it a fine. That's all it is. It's not a court cost. It's not a fine, because fine are for guilty people. Special expense fees are for lucky, successful probationers. Okay? So it's just the way that the government gets to take your money by calling it something else. Well, the difference is the Court of Appeals said, hey, if the criminal defense lawyer had gotten this guy a Class C special expense, they repeatedly use this term, Class C special expense, he would have gotten an expunction under Chapter 55. That was malpractice. Shame on you, criminal defense lawyer. Okay, so how many of you are ready to call your insurance carriers getting ready to up your premiums? How many of you recognize what this case is? If you're a criminal defense lawyer, do you see what this case could potentially mean to you in terms of what you have to, get it in writing? I have explained to you, I mean, I'm not a huge defender of criminal defense lawyers, but I know in fairness when I see it. This is a ridiculous burden to put on criminal defense lawyers, to try to get them something, one, that's not authorized by law, or two, something that's inapplicable in the specific case. And this really shows a local custom of what's more custom in that part of the state. All right, worst case of the year. Okay, I'm going to go fast on the next couples. We don't have a lot of time left. I want to talk to you about Caperton and just tell you this. Recusal is not just an ethics violation. It can become a 14th Amendment due process violation. And this is the case you all heard about where, like, I think the justice was in Colorado, and he got, like, all this money for his reelection. He didn't recuse himself. By the way, this might be the worst year in the history for A.T. Massey Company. This is the same group that had the mining collapse and the horrible publicity from that. They were the other party in this case. They need, like, maybe a total makeover or something. They need someone to come help them with their public image. I mention this to you, though, because I think, you know, The cases that they cite in this case actually relate to municipal courts. Did y'all know that? They cite two cases, one about a municipal court judge who was getting paid out of municipal court fines. How many of you think that maybe that's not a good idea either in terms of fairness? Judge, we will pay you, but only if you convict people. That used to be the law. They used to have a fee system. Prosecutors got paid the same way. Shame on you. That can't work. Okay? That violates the 14th Amendment. And also, they cite the case that says that mayors acting as judges presiding over trials. Toomey versus Ohio, which is another old case, that violates the 14th Amendment. Hasn't forced the state of Texas to repeal a provision in law that says that if you're a general law city, that your mayor can act as ex officio judge. But, forget it. It's just a Supreme Court decision, right? I mean, what's that really mean to us? We're Texas. Okay, so that's Caperton. That's a big case that you ought to know. Here's what you need to remember. It's not just an ethics violation if you fail to recuse. It could be a 14th Amendment violation. That's what the case stands for. Now, for you folks who make more of your money as criminal defense lawyers than municipal judges, perk up on Karenev too, because this is a game changer. For years, the law has been this. When you make a challenge, there's two types of challenges to a statute. There is challenge as applied, and there's a facial validity challenge. Challenge as applied means that there's something specific about the way the law was applied to a person that makes it unconstitutional, okay? Facial validity means it doesn't matter how you apply it to anyone, it's unconstitutional, okay? What the law has been until this last year was that when it came to as applied challenges, you must make that objection at the first trial court. You have to make it immediately, okay? You can't wait. But when it comes to facial validity challenges, you could raise that for the first time on appeal. No more. The Court of Criminal Appeals has shot down that entire line of case law. Now you are required to raise both facial and as-applied challenges in the trial court. And this is where it gets really slippery. Do you think for a second in the opinion they said, now, if this is in a court of non-record, this case is inapplicable, or this case is a... Do you think they said anything? Do you think they even contemplated the possibility that these type of challenges could be raised in a municipal or justice court? Or what would this case mean in a municipal court of record? They didn't. So I'll tell you this. I think if I'm advising my criminal defense lawyer friends, or if I'm advising anyone, you have to raise all of them now. I don't care if you're in a non-record court. I don't care if you're in a court of record, because you're still going to have... Even in a non-record court, there's going to be a transcript. A record is going to consist of any documents filed in the case. This case tends to suggest you have to do it all at the court of first instance, or you may have waived it. All right, that's Karenev. Okay. Barr versus the City of Sinton. I just want to throw this word out. The Texas Religious Freedoms Protection Act. I left in a letter off my PowerPoint. My apologies to the letter F. The TRFPA. I want y'all to know what that is, because it is a statute that was used in this case to defeat a city ordinance, where they basically tried to tell a guy he couldn't have a transitional living center for a person who had just gotten out of a jail, and this guy was doing it as part of his church outreach, and the city tried to use their zoning laws to block him from being able to do this. Texas Supreme Court shot down that zoning ordinance based off the TRFPA. I think all of you need to know what the TRFPA is and be prepared to see it used as a defensive argument. Okay, Trulock versus the City of Duncanville. Are any of y'all from the Dallas-Fort Worth area? Any of y'all remember this case? This got a lot of news. I don't know why, but Fox News particularly liked this story. They loved it. Okay, has to do with the swinging lifestyle. Okay, we got this guy who's having sex parties at his house. That there's no way to get him on prostitution charges because money's not exchanging hands, so the city decides to create a zoning ordinance that regulates adult parties where you have sex with other people? I don't know. It's really kind of a strange zoning ordinance. Okay, now if you don't know what the swinging lifestyle is, here, allow me to illustrate it through a couple of choice lines from the motion picture Raising Arizona. How many of y'all have seen Raising Arizona? Have you seen it? Okay, here we go. 1987, High says, "What are you talking about, Glenn?" How many of y'all remember the scene of the movie already? You got it? Okay, here we go. Glenn says, "What am I talking about? I'm talking about sex, boy. What the heck are you talking about? I'm talking about Ella Moore. I'm talking about me and Dot are swingers, as in two swing. I'm talking about wife swapping. I'm talking about what they call nowadays an open marriage." There you go. Thank you, Coen Brothers. All right, here we go. In this specific situation, what the city did is they prosecuted them in municipal court for violating the city ordinance while simultaneously suing them in civil court. Then what happened is that the defendant, Mr. Trulock, tried to get injunctive relief. And every time he, this was, I offer this case up because it's a perfect illustration. You know, in municipal courts, they can't sentence you to death, but man, they can certainly make you wish you were dead. All right? And this is a perfect case of how the process can be the punishment for some people. Because what happens is, every time this guy almost perfects his request for civil relief, the city either abandons the criminal prosecution in municipal court, making his civil request moot, or they modify the ordinance so that the law is constantly changing. And every time he's trying to ask for extraordinary relief, the Court of Appeals is saying, sorry, it's not ripe. We can't. That's no longer how the law reads. Try again. And it just shows you how when a city really wants to go after you, man, the 1-2 combination of a little Class C misdemeanor magic on the left and a little civil injunctive punch on the right, it could really ruin your sex parties. That's my bottom line on this. Now, I'm going to tell you a true story. My wife and I, we live in Southwest Austin. We had one of these things happen near our house. And my homeowners association, we got a bunch of lawyers living in the homeowner association. And like I was wanting to go after them on the basis that the people weren't living in the house and they said they were in their mortgage application. I was wanting to get them defaulted on their home loan. And people, the other ones, oh, that's interference of contract. We could all get sued. So what they wanted to do is they wanted to get KI to bring in the investigative news and do like a 60 minutes gotcha type thing. And I was like, great, because that's really going to improve our home values. That was my thing. Come on down to Western Trails where we have sex parties on Friday and Saturday night. Come see the ugly people. They're coming down on buses. You know, so anyway, we had this happen, and lo and behold, this is no joke, KI comes out with their video cameras. And they were literally going down to a nursing home, dropping these people off at the nursing home. Then they had a shuttle bus that was running them from the nursing home to the sex party. You know, and these people, like, they turned on these floodlights and they shamed them out of our neighborhood. They agreed that if KI would go away, they would no longer have sex in that house again. Or whatever, you know, whatever they're doing behind closed doors. The only thing I know is they were dropping money in a hat to cover concessions. They're wearing, like, fishnet stockings and stuff, latex bodysuits. They're going into some room and who knows what's happening. Horrible acts of human twister, I imagine. Anyway, they're going in there. And then the other thing is, this poor neighbor of mine, and this is the last one, I'm sorry I'm going to leave this. This one guy, he goes, I just need this to end because last weekend, I'm not joking, and I laughed when he said it, and I know I shouldn't have laughed. It was horrible, but it was funny. I shouldn't have laughed. He goes, I need this to end because last weekend, I had to pick up 56 condoms out of my backyard, and I started laughing like I was a freshman in high school. I was so embarrassed. All right, okay, here we go. Transportation code. Hardy obstruction of roadway. This is Camp Casey in McLennan County. This is the case, George Bush's ranch in Crawford is right down here. This was the case where, once again, just because a local government has a problem, that doesn't mean the solution is to always adopt an ordinance, okay? These people are protesting. They don't like the war. They also don't like the fact that this lady's son got killed, okay? They're camping on this little triangular piece of land. So what does the county commissioners do? They pass what they call an ordinance. By the way, go check the law and see what the authority of a county commissioner is to pass an ordinance. It is none. They can pass regulations authorized by the state, and that's it. If they pass an ordinance banning camping on this triangle, okay, so what did the protesters do? They move into the ditches right here alongside the roadways. Now, let me ask you something. They said that the reason you couldn't camp here is because it wasn't safe. How many of you think campers are safer sleeping in road ditches on dirt roads? I don't know about you, but in the part of the Texas where I come from, that's where the drunks in their pickup trucks quite often end up, is in the ditch. Okay, so here we are. You got protesters in the ditch. They come back now. They arrest everyone for obstruction of roadway. The case poses the question, where's the roadway? Okay, good question. Does it include the ditch? Okay. The Court of Appeals in Waco threw out the conviction because they found that the evidence was legally insufficient. In the light most favorable to the verdict, to the trier of fact, that elements could not be found beyond a reasonable doubt because the cops kept testifying during the trial. They started talking about this blasted ordinance. And it is true, when you read the transcript, you can't tell if the officers, when they said, well, they engaged in illegality, you can't tell if the illegality stems from the ordinance or if it stems from the state law. And that's the reason why the conviction was reversed and the Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed that conviction. I mean, excuse me, they affirmed the decision of the Court of Appeals. All right, here's another one. Where does your license plate have to be located on your car? The front of the vehicle. What does that mean? What's the front of the vehicle? Okay, well, guess what? In Austin, the front of the vehicle means inside the windshield tucked up on the dashboard. That's what the Court of Appeals in Austin has said. However, that is not in line with what the Court of Appeals, I believe it is in Amarillo, if I'm not mistaken. In Spence versus State, they go, front of the vehicle means front bumper, not windshield, front bumper. All right, so now we've got another division over the burning question of where is the front of the motor vehicle. All right, by the way, one I'm looking at right now is the Court of Criminal Appeals took PDR. When you hit a fork in the road and you're driving, do you have to use your turn signal? In Houston, they will arrest you and get you on DWI and drug charges if you don't. But there's a disagreement now statewide about when must you use your turn signal when you encounter a fork in the road. Yeah. Hey, man, what can I say? You know, maybe they thought you were suspicious persons. Here we go. All right. Virial is another case involving a municipal court acting as a magistrate. This is out of Amarillo. Mr. Virial complained about the fact that the magistrate's order of emergency protection did not contain the most recent language as adopted by the Texas legislature. Y'all remember when they expanded the scope to include dating violence? Y'all remember that? He got busted on dating violence, but the form did not reflect the law. He said, how can I have notice of where I can't go and what I can't do if it didn't say so on the piece of paper? All right? Court of Criminal Appeals didn't go for it. I doubt that the Supreme Court of the United States went for it. He's trying to get his case heard by the Supreme Court of the United States. I will tell you this. This case is worthy of your attention because this is what you need to carry away from it. When session is over, it is time to revise and check every one of your forms to make sure that the language is current. Because if they had done that, this wouldn't have been a problem. When we were doing this, Katie, who works in our office, Katie was terrified. She goes, oh God, I hope they weren't using the TMCEC forms book. Well, it wasn't, thank goodness. But if they had been, they would have had the most recent version of the law because we do update our forms after every session, all right? Okay, last case, or almost last case. This is a case that y'all may see misrepresented. In the hall, the individual is stopped for DWI. The basis for the stop is speeding. That's the probable cause to believe a criminal offense is committed. The basis for the stop is LIDAR. How many of you are seeing peace officers use LIDAR now? Okay. What happened is the conviction was thrown out on appeal because the Court of Criminal Appeals once again agreed with the Intermediate Court of Appeals that the evidence was legally insufficient because the prosecutor never asked the questions and the testifying witness never laid the predicate as to how LIDAR works. I tell you this because be careful. I've already seen some lawyers try to use this case to stand for the proposition that, one, you have to have a Daubert or Kelly Fry gate hearing, scientific hearing. That's bunk. That's not what this case stands for. Secondly, I've seen this case stand for, people try to argue, this case says that the Court of Criminal Appeals says you can't use LIDAR because it's not reliable. That's not what they said either. The only thing they said, and this is great, this is an opinion by Judge Price. Judge Price says, if you've got a magical blue box, the blue box lights up every time someone's speeding, you can't come into a trial court and testify, how did you know they were speeding? Because the blue box lit up. Because that doesn't tell the appellate court or anyone else what the person's basis for believing that they... So in other words, this isn't a problem with the technology. This is a problem with the prosecutor and a problem with the cop. It should have been, officer, why did you believe he was speeding? You can't say, blue box. You have to say, LIDAR. Explain how LIDAR works. It uses a laser beam. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, 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 blah. Probably even if they had said blah, 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 that would have worked. Okay? But you had to have said something and not just said, Why did you think he was speeding? LIDAR. Okay, next question. Because that's what happened. The prosecutor stopped asking questions when he probably should have asked a couple more questions. All right, let's wind it down here. Times are tough. People are looking for money. If you don't know about the statute that allows criminal courts to take money out of people's TDCJ commissary funds, study up on these cases. The Office of Court Administration has told me they do not think it was the legislative intent that municipal or justice courts use these statutes. However, when you read the statute, you will see there is nothing prohibiting a municipal or justice court from using the formula to garnish wages out of someone's account who's down there in the pen. Finally, school attendance. How many of y'all hear school attendance cases? Is it a reasonable condition to use GPS tracking on kids who are on deferred disposition for failure to attend school? The Attorney General has said yes. But I'm going to advise you to be careful with this. Do you think it's a reasonable condition to use GPS on kids who are on deferred disposition for failure to attend school 24/7, 365, including hours that are not school hours? That's where we're going to have problems with this, is when judges try to increase the scope beyond the particular application of school time hours. All right, folks, that's my time. Enjoy your lunch. I'll talk to you down the road. Thank you.